Welcome to the Wine Atelier Podcast, your insider's guide to mastering wine with certified sommelier Stephanie Miskew.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Wine Atelier Podcast, your insider's guide to mastering wine. I'm your host Stephanie Miskew, and thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm super excited about today's episode because I have a very special guest with me, and that is Mr., or should I say Master, Eric Hemmer. And I'm really excited to have Eric on the show because he is one of only four people on the planet who has achieved both the Master Sommelier and Master of Wine credential. He also happens to be Senior Vice President and Corporate Director of Wine Education for Southern Glazers, Wine and Spirits of America. And he's been with them actually for 30 years. And he started just as a fine wine consultant in the Palm Beaches here in South Florida. Today, he is actively involved as a lecturer, examiner, and instructor with the Court of Master Sommeliers, the Institute of Masters of Wine, the Wine and Spirit Education Trust, and the Society of Wine Educators. So we're so lucky to have Eric here today. Welcome, Eric.
Well, thank you, Stephanie. I appreciate all those Nice glowing accolades.
Well, you make it really easy, I have to say.
Oh, good. Yeah. I try not to let them get in my way when I talk to people because I'm, after all, the same humble wine lover that I was 30 years ago when I first started as a young, ambitious sales rep up in the Palm Beaches. So.
Well, and I'm so glad you said that because on a personal note, like you were such a great inspiration to me when I was trying to figure out that I wanted to make wine my career and how to go about that. We met at one of Jean-Pierre's cooking classes down in Fort Lauderdale. I think you're still involved with him too, I think.
Yes, I am.
And you took the time, you were so kind and took the time after one of your classes to give me some great advice and explain more about the Court of Master Sommeliers. And then in a full circle moment, you're actually one of the master somms there who administered my certified sommelier exam. So,
yep, happy times, I remember.
Oh, yeah. I've never been happier to pass something in my life. But but anyway, thank you so much. And I'm just really excited to have you here today.
Well, great. I'm happy to be here.
Great.
So we're going to talk about some wine trends, what's going on out in the marketplace.
Yep, it's January. What better time and what better person to discuss, you know, wine trends for 2019 with. So, why don't you tell me a little bit about what you're thinking we're going to see more of this year?
Okay, well, it's kind of a nice time to do that because I just finished reviewing last year and I have some good numbers on categories that I think were strong last year and will continue to grow into 2019. And some of these won't be a surprise to anybody listening because the first one, of course, is that phenomenon known as dry rosé.
Oh, yes.
especially from Provence and the south of France, we're just seeing no slowing down in that category at all. And of course, now everybody is on the rosé bandwagon, and not just drinkable rosé too, but of course, edible rosé and frozen rosé. And if you could inject rosé, I'm sure somebody would find a way to do it.
Yes, that's probably coming for 2019, right?
Yeah, let's hope not. Rosé eyeballing. Remember, that's an awful trend.
Good. So you see that kind of just, it's still kind of gaining momentum. You see more growth with that.
Lots of growth. And again, I see it from all areas of the world, but in particular from the south of France and Provence. At Southern last year, we had 63% growth in 2018 on that category, on top of strong growth in the previous 2 years. So it's just going like crazy. And looking at numbers from January, since we're here at the end of the month, a couple brands in particular that I think are helping to lead the charge. One is Chateau d'Esclan, which of course is the producer of Whispering Angel, et cetera, was up 30% in 2018 and up 17% this January versus last January. So still continuing growth on a really big base. And there's a lot of that product being sold in the marketplace and it doesn't look like it's slowing down. Another brand that's up high double digits was from Gerard Bertrand, which is from Languedoc, south of France, called Côte de Rose. Mm-hmm. Also up double digits and 24% growth in January versus the previous year. So huge, huge growth potential there still. I don't think it's going to stop. And the reason is, I think finally people have accepted dry rosé. When I say people, I mean in particular men.
Yes.
It seems like in the past, rosé was somewhat discriminated against by male consumers for many reasons, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Pink wine not being the most masculine looking thing in the glass.
I mean, even here in South Florida, I have to say, like at my events, men were like kind of the last holdout that they really, you kind of needed to say, look, real men drink pink. It's okay. And then honestly, once they tried it, it was like a done deal. Like it's delicious, but just going.
Yeah, I think a lot of people look at it with preconceived notions and, oh, it's white Zinfandel, it's sweet, it's low alcohol, I'm not going to like it. Mm-hmm. But then when they find out, oh, it's made with grapes like Syrah and Grenache and Mourvèdre and all these big, powerful red wine grapes, and then they taste it, they quickly realize, hey, this is good, it is versatile and food friendly, and why not?
You know? Absolutely, absolutely.
If they can wear pink Izod shirts, they can certainly drink a glass of pink wine. You know, it's not gonna hurt anybody.
Right? I love that comparison. That's wonderful. And just for people listening, anyone listening, my last podcast actually was an interview with Paul Chevalier of Chateau d'Esclans. So for anyone looking to learn more about their rosés and their really amazing story, feel free to check that out when you get a chance.
Yeah, good.
So please
beautiful.
Come on. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, it's a beautiful place too. If anybody ever gets the chance to go to Provence and go visit the winery. There's a lot going on there. Sasha Lachine, the owner, is just building his second winery there to handle the demand for Whispering Angel worldwide. And it's a beautiful state-of-the-art facility in a gorgeous little Mediterranean setting. So definitely worth the trip.
It sure is. Yeah, it sure is. We were just there in October and we had been there a few years before, and it just, the difference, you're right, is amazing. Like the number of stainless steel tanks and all of that. It's just like increased a lot.
Yeah, it really has. And I think people get the idea that because they produce a lot of wine, it's from a less than high quality source, and nothing could be further from the truth. And he's really doing everything he can to maintain that quality level as he's increasing production to meet demand. So it's the new winery is really a good example of how he's investing in the brand.
Absolutely. I'm so glad you just said that too, because we've seen that happen with other brands along over the years, about it got popular and started getting mass produced and the quality really kind of dropped. But this wine is definitely one that hasn't. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah. So enough on rosé. Let's move on. Look at some other categories. I think sparkling wine in general is having a wonderful moment. Had a great year last year. And if you look across the board at the various regions, from Champagne to Cava in Spain to, of course, Prosecco, Northern Italy, and even domestic traditional method sparkling wines are all did great in 2018. And are continuing strongly into the new year. I just read something this morning, and you probably saw the same thing. For the first time in 50 years, France has exported more champagne abroad than they consumed internally.
Yes.
And the key export markets continue to be the U.S. And Japan and Australia. So strong increases in champagne production. Of course, right now we've got a strong dollar versus a weaker euro, so it's a great time to buy European wines or take a European vacation.
Yes, I'm glad to hear we're doing our part to support sparkling wine here in the U.S.
Yes, we are. And at all levels, all premium levels and above, Prosecco, of course, continues to just amaze me because, again, kind of like dry rosé from the south of France, it does not seem to be slowing down at all. With 3 years growth, strong growth, maybe more. I look back to 2016, 2017, but I think it was growing even before that. And in 2019, we at Southern are up 53% in sales over last year on the category. So it just continues to grow. And the cool thing, I think, is that consumers are realizing there is more than just basic Prosecco, and they're interested in Superiore. They're interested in Cartizze and some of the, you know, better appellations for Prosecco production. Mm. And you're really starting to see that evolve now. And it's reflective on wine lists and in stores. And it's kind of like we used to talk about with Côte d'Aron versus Côte d'Aron Village. Mm-hmm. For a couple dollars more, you can get a lot better quality. So we're starting to see that with Prosecco as well.
Great. Are there any particular brands of Prosecco? Because I know people kind of go out there and there's so many different brands out there. Are there any particular brands that you would recommend to folks?
Well, there's a bunch of them, and I try not to play favorites because we love all of our children equally.
Yes.
But I would have to say that one of our category leaders is Mio Netto. And Mionetta produces a lot of different labels, a lot of different levels of quality, extra dry brutes, both DOC and DOCG. And it's easy to find out there at retail. So if people are looking for a good, reliable brand, look for Mionetta. And again, if you like something with a little more complexity, look for those terms Superiore on the label or DOCG indicating the highest level of quality. Or as you know, the villages Conigliano and Valdobbiadene. Mm-hmm. A bit of a tongue twister. So just look for the DOCG on the label and you can't go wrong.
Absolutely. And I couldn't agree with you more. Mionetta is probably my favorite Prosecco, or definitely one of them. Wonderful.
And of course, there's many, many others. And the nice thing is that everybody's stocking more than just one or two labels now. And you even walk into Publix or any supermarket and you can have a nice array of Prosecco labels to choose from.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And how about sparkling wine from the U.S.?
Yeah, we're seeing really strong growth on traditional method sparklers from California, from Oregon, all over the place. It's really, sparkling wine seems to be moving out of that holiday OND, you know, time period, and it's being consumed all year long now. So we're seeing really good, strong growth in all of those categories. And if you haven't had good traditional method sparkling wine from Oregon these days, you know, we talk about California all the time, but I think Oregon is having a moment with sparkling wine too, because of the, you know, the cooler climates, and they just seem to grow really, really pure examples of Chardonnay and Pinot Noir based sparkling wine. So those are really good. So we're seeing good, strong growth there, especially again, you know, good news for the premium level and above. You know, wines above $20 in the sparkling set are doing extremely well, along with those Proseccos and Cavas that fall into that $10 to $20 retail range.
Yeah, so there really is wonderful sparkling wine available at virtually all price points, which is so nice.
Yeah, there really is. With a little bit of price comparison, you can really satisfy yourself, yeah, at all price levels. And it's nice to see too that we're now seeing some super premium cuvées above $30 from regions other than Champagne that are doing well. For example, Franciacorta,
yes,
from Northern Italy is doing quite well, as is Trentadoc wines, which I think may have more in common with a Champagne style, just due to that slightly cooler climate there too. So we're seeing good interest in those categories. We're seeing above $30 domestic cuvées. For example, Rotorua Estate L'Hermitage is a really nice reserve vintage wine from the Rotorua people in Anderson Valley. So wines like that are doing extremely well.
Wonderful. Well, thank you. Those are so many great recommendations. I'm sure everyone is writing them down as they're listening. That's wonderful.
So yeah, moving on, Sauvignon Blanc is also experiencing strong growth. And of course, I don't think anybody would not be able to figure out what was driving that growth. And of course, that drum roll, please. Barbara Zealand, right? It continues to really go gangbusters. But it's really, I think it's one of those things, a rising tide floats all ships, where people really love Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc, and it's getting them to try Sauvignon Blancs from other places that they might not have considered before, such as California, of course, but also places like Chile and South Africa, and really all the other coolish climates around that produce good quality Sauvignon Blanc. So that's a big one, really going strong.
That's wonderful. And I love how Sauvignon Blanc, it really can, I mean, while it retains the same, you know, characteristics, high acidity and beautiful fruit, but it really does taste differently, you know, like New Zealand Sauv Blanc from California Sauv Blanc. Like, I always find Sauvignon Blanc very interesting in that respect too.
Yeah, it really does. It really reflects the terroir it comes from.
Yes.
And it's always fun to taste, you know, especially in a blind tasting, to taste a Sancerre with its chalky, high acid, really green fruit characteristics versus a warmer climate Sauvignon Blanc from Napa, for example. Mm-hmm. And it just amazes people when they taste the two wines blind.
Right.
They can't believe it's made from the same grape variety when you reveal. So it's that's a lot of fun. A lot of versatility, which is, I think, one of the things that's making it an interesting category once again, now especially that it's being treated more like Sancerre than it is California Chardonnay. Used to be that most California Sauvignon Blancs were on the oaky side. I can remember trying to sell them back in the day, and people just didn't want to even consider Sauvignon Blanc unless you put it through barrel fermentation and did some lees stirring and little malolactic fermentation to try to make it more like Chardonnay.
Yeah.
And of course, it doesn't need any of that. It's such a wonderfully aromatic variety on its own that I'm finally very happy to see that the unadorned, unoaked style of Sauvignon Blanc is the category leader once again.
Absolutely. What do you think made kind of change people's minds to kind of, you know, try not to make it like Chardonnay and helped people kind of just appreciate it for what it was, a beautiful, fruit forward, high acid wine?
Well, I think the world owes that to New Zealand. I think it was back in the mid 80s, you know, late 80s, when that style really began to take off, and some pretty well-respected wine writers like Hugh Johnson, et cetera, had tasted some of these wines coming out of the Marlborough region in New Zealand and said, wow, this is incredible. Because it was a lot like Sancerre, but with riper fruit, yet high acid. And it really sort of was that perfect balance of crisp, vibrant acidity and ripe, almost tropical fruit notes that really made the world sit up and take notice. And I think from that point on, everybody said, hey, we want to make our Sauvignon Blanc more like the New Zealand style, which of course was really an emulation of the Loire style to begin with. So,
right.
You know, they say something about flattery being the greatest compliment.
Right. And yet still very different in its own right, which is wonderful. And such a great wine to enjoy here in South Florida too.
Yeah.
Most of the year.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty much all the time, even when it's drops into the 50s here. Ooh.
That's so true. I know. Let me get my winter coat out. I'm going to sip some Sauvignon Blanc.
Yeah. So looking across the board domestically, and these are based upon our numbers, but you know, we're we have a pretty big footprint in the country, and we cover 45 markets. So I think if these numbers are that way for us, I think it's a pretty good reflection of the market in general. But domestic wines had a really good year in 2018. After being outperformed by imports the previous year, which was interesting. So we're seeing renewed interest in California wines. Cabernet Sauvignon and Pinot Noir were up substantially, Sauvignon Blanc up substantially. But the big winner, again, is blended red wines.
Gotcha.
Coming out of California, blended red sales were up 49% overall at Southern last year. So that was from Sonoma alone, but overall blends were up double digits.
Wow.
So yeah, people just love their red blends. And I think a lot of that is coming from younger generations, from millennials, maybe even some of the older Generation Z consumers that are really enamored with the style of red blends. You know, they're fruity and juicy and ripe and easy to like. And a lot of them come with catchy, even interactive labels, which, you know, is very appealing to the younger consumer. I still can't figure out how to make one of those codes talk.
Right, I know. Like, what are you talking about? I mean, that's funny. And how do you think Merlot kind of fits into the red wine, the increase in blends and such? Do you think Merlot is officially back? Do you think it plays a part in the popularity of blends? How do you think this?
Well, that's a two-part answer, because I do think that it's playing a part in blends, thankfully, because as a single variety, it's not doing well still. Numbers were down on Merlot again last year, as they were on Syrah from California. But I think in blends, that could be the saving grace. I think ultimately, you know, everything comes around full circle.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Merlot will again have its day in the sun from California and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just sort of a domestic Merlot generalization. I'm sure there are brighter pockets here and there. But it was one topic of conversation I had in Sonoma 2 weeks ago. With some of the wine growers, hey, you know, what do we do about Merlot? You know, prices continue to drop on the spot market, and you know, these guys are farmers and they rely upon selling their crop every year, just like anybody growing corn or wheat or what have you. And with a big glut last year, was a huge bumper crop in California and elsewhere around the world, and A lot of people are looking at an oversupply situation. So it really makes you feel for those guys that are actually growing the grapes.
No kidding.
Because you can't just, you know, wave a magic wand and, you know, bud over your entire vineyard overnight. You know, it takes time to do this. And of course, we saw that happen back when Merlot first got popular back in the early 90s. You know, a lot of people said, oh, let's get rid of this other stuff and put Merlot in the ground. And, you know, now, you know, they're kind of stuck with this. But I do think, you know, Merlot will come back based on its own attributes. It's a high quality grape variety. And when grown in the right conditions, it makes wonderful, beautiful wine. You know, look at Miles and his Cheval Blanc.
Exactly. The great irony of the movie.
So I think it'll have its day. And the nice thing, I think, is that Australian Shiraz is starting, the Australians are starting to recover a bit from that disaster. That was a long, more than a decade long period of people, consumers just, you know, pulling away from Shiraz. And now we're starting to see a lot more regionality, you know, Australian producers showcasing better quality wines from specific appellations. And I really think that's their strength. They can do that pretty easily as long as Mother Nature cooperates, because right now they're in the midst of huge droughts and fires and everything. It's sort of the antithesis of what's going on here in North America right now with record cold. So climate change, whether you're a firm believer or a non-believer or somewhere in between, I think the wine industry is a very good bellwether example of what's going on.
Right. It seems like no matter who you ask, I mean, who's ever making wine, whether over in France, here in California, it seems like everyone's pretty unanimous in that, you know, things are changing. Would you agree?
Oh, there's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
Like I said, I don't think there's any clearer examples out there in any industries than there is in the wine industry about what's going on, because we tend to look at, you know, what's happening in the wine industry globally, especially, you know, from a big distributor point of view, because we are, you know, concerned with what's happening in Australia as well as elsewhere around the world. So you see these huge extremes. It's not so much global warming or global freezing. Both are going on, but they're all part of a bigger picture called climate change.
Right.
And it's certainly prevalent in the wine industry. Everybody's concerned about it. We were, I was in Piedmont last fall, not to continue to brag about the places I've been. But
oh, continue. We want to hear.
Sort of goes with the territory, but we had a very meaningful conversation with a producer there, Pio Boffa, who runs Pio Cesare in Barolo. And he's hedging his bets by buying land. He's continuing to acquire vineyard land, but at higher elevations. And he just bought a considerably big piece of land that's a good, I think he said it was 500 meters higher than his appellations in Barolo. So trying to hedge his bets for the future, you know, to protect the family business for the next couple of generations.
Okay.
If things continue to get too warm to grow Nebbiolo, where they're at now in Barbaresco and Barolo, hey, he's got some land tucked away at higher appellations or higher elevations. Where they can continue on. So you see a lot of instances of that around the world. Miguel Torres in Spain was talking about the same thing. I'm, you know, planting at higher elevations up in the Alta Penedès, just to, you know, protect against what if, you know, what if my vineyards, you know, it gets too hot to produce good quality here. I have vineyards at higher elevations I can go to. So you're hearing a lot of that from producers and growers and winemakers all around the world, everywhere.
Everywhere. Wow, yeah. That's impressive. And for people listening, just so when you're planting at higher elevations, right, you're talking about cooler temperatures that won't, you know, ripen the grapes too fast, because that's what's happening in, you know, where regions get too warm, correct?
That is correct.
Yeah.
Now, the bright side of that is it's also helping people ripen fruit in regions that were once previously too cold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. But, the flip side.
Yeah, that's the flip side. So there is a silver lining. For people. So if you've got some land up in, you know, Idaho or Western Montana, you know, hang on to it.
Right.
It might be suitable for viticulture. So a good example there is in Southern England, you know, in the British Isles, where even champagne producers have been investing in vineyards there and planting Pinot Noir and Chardonnay and producing some really nice quality English sparkling wine.
That's true. I've tried a few and they're pretty delicious.
Yeah, they really are. And they're very, I mean, you can't say it's as good as champagne because it's not, but who knows, in 10 years or 15 years when vineyards get more mature, they might be producing wines that are comparable to champagne in terms of quality, because the climate is becoming much more similar to champagne than cold, wet, damp Britain.
Interesting.
Tell anybody in London that right now and they won't believe you, because it's still cold. wet, damp London.
Right, right. Just hang in there. Won't that be fun to see how that goes? Yeah. Right. Wow.
Yeah. So those are all cool things that are happening right now. And there's some other things that we're seeing. It's sort of interesting to me to just look at the continuous steady growth in new wineries here in the United States and not in California, outside of
California. Else? I'd love to hear what other states are kind of really up and coming as far as wine making goes.
Well, I think if you look at the past decade, both Washington and Oregon have more than tripled the amount of wineries in those two states, which is huge.
Wow.
And you're also seeing more than tripled in the case of Oregon. They're over 700 wineries down the state, which is, if you go back to 1975 in the United States, there were 579 wineries in the U.S., in the entire U.S.
Wow.
Now, this past year, we added 408 new wineries, and we now have 10,000 plus wineries in the United States.
Wow.
So Oregon has more wineries today than the entire U.S. did 40 years ago. So it's pretty amazing, the staggering growth. But places like Long Island, I was up on Long Island in November for Thanksgiving and visiting some really, really incredible producers up there on the North Fork of Long Island. So New York State, the Eastern Seaboard, Virginia, North Carolina all have many, many new wineries. I think over 300 now in Virginia and approaching 200 or maybe even over 200 in North Carolina. I'd have to look, but pretty amazing. And, you know, people producing good quality wines in place that you never would have realized they make good wine in, like Colorado, Arizona.
Wow.
You know, all over the U.S., all 50 states have a commercial wine industry of some size. So continued steady growth. And now less than 50% of the U.S. wineries, or I should say, California now produces less than 50% of all. Sorry, what am I trying to say? California has less than 50% of all the wineries in the United States now. I think 45%.
Really?
Yeah, 45% are in California, 55% elsewhere.
Wow.
But when you look, it's a pretty big shift. But most of those wineries, 80% or so, are under 5,000 cases of production. So
You
know, the big kahunas of the industry will remain in California, no doubt about it.
For now.
For now. And you're seeing some bigger players in Washington and Oregon, as there's been a lot of increased interest in Oregon by California producers. A lot of people have been moving north and buying wineries. The Jackson family, for example.
Yes.
We're seeing the Wagner family making wine in Oregon now. So a lot of people interested in Oregon, and it almost raises the question, when will we reach, you know, a point of saturation when there's too many wineries and not enough consumers? But hopefully,
I don't see that happening.
Hopefully
if
not.
If my clients are any indication, I just can't even imagine that happening.
Yeah, hopefully not. It's a nightmare that I often think about it. What if we have too much wine and not enough people to buy it?
Yeah, I think that's a ways off.
Stephanie, from your lips to the wine consumer's ears. Hopefully everybody's listening to you and buying wine.
Right? We'll just pitch in and have to do our part. So
I'm afraid the older generations are going to have to start drinking more, because
I know
early indicators are that the two youngest legal generations are not as interested in wine as we are. So
that's interesting. Hopefully they come around, right?
And maybe they will as they get more money. And, you know, I think a lot of younger people, you know, look at wine as being a bit extravagant compared to craft beers or cocktails. So hopefully as they get older and become more economically successful or financially successful, they'll, you know, drink wine. And not that they don't drink wine, but we're not seeing a lot of trading up. So
gotcha.
A little bit of a concern to the wine industry right now. And there's a lot of industry disruptors out there too, that we're seeing more and more talk about, you know, legal recreational cannabis in the United States.
Yes. How do you think that is going to affect the wine market? I can't wait to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, well, I think it may affect the wine market. Right now, I think there's more concern from the beer industry than there is from the wine industry. But everybody's looking at it very carefully. And there's been a number of surveys that have been done. None are particularly conclusive as to whether it will take away from alcoholic beverage sales or not. There are some tax studies done by the three big states that have been legal for a while now, Colorado, Washington, Oregon, California may have been in that too, that show that there's been no decrease in distilled spirit sales over the time that cannabis has been legal for recreational use. But there's been another report recently that said it may affect the beer industry, that some beer enthusiasts, when they're enjoying legal cannabis, may drink less beer. So we're hoping that's not the case for wine, but it could be. So everybody's sort of watching this space to see how that progresses. And you see a lot of wine companies are hedging their bets, much like growers are buying vineyards at higher altitudes. We're seeing a lot of big wine companies invest in cannabis.
Yes, I think I just read an article. Was it Constellation that just...
Yeah, Constellation took a $4 billion, not million, billion dollar stake in a company called Canopy Growth Corporation.
Wow.
So they're really, you know, betting on cannabis taking off in the U.S. Of course, you know, everybody's seen what's happened in Canada when they went legal back in September. And every day you read something about a new U.S. state, you know, getting ready for legalization. New York and New Jersey are the latest two to talk about it.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's something that's going to be here. It's just a question of will it really affect our industry and the wine industry. So, again, it just kind of remains to be seen. We'll see what happens.
Well, I know it's funny. What seems like the Wild West kind of today, like, well, how is this going to happen? I wonder how long it will take for that to really firm up and to really get a sense of what that's about. But
yeah, well, the big stopgap in the U.S. is it's not federally legal. In Canada, it is now federally legal. So that, you know, every country, well, you know, Canada is sort of does things a little bit differently, but they have provinces, not states. But it is now legal across, you know, across the country. So if and when the U.S. decides to make it constitutionally legal, then you'll see a lot of states going that way. Because the nice thing about legal cannabis is sort of twofold. You take money out of the illegal drug trade, and you put money into state coffers that desperately need tax dollars. So we're seeing that with states that were really nearly bankrupt, like California, legalizing and controlling and regulating and taxing the sale of legal cannabis is a great, great way to sort of put some more money in those empty coffers.
Right, right.
You know, I think that's the real big impetus. That and just the softening of a stance. You know, the U.S. used to treat cannabis like heroin. It really didn't differentiate
that's so true.
A deadly drug and what we would consider today a very soft drug. So it really should be treated like alcohol, in my opinion.
Yeah, and anyway. It's funny how that stance was so firm for so long and just seems kind of in the past, what is it, 5-7 years?
I think things, you know, a lot of paradigms shift quickly these days.
Yeah.
And that's been one of them. I mean, I can remember as a kid, reefer madness, just, you know, go blind and insane, you know. Not that I'm advocating, not that I'm an advocate of consumption. I'm just taking a 360 degree view.
Of course. Oh, that's great. Yeah. So maybe as we evolve, I'll check back with you on this issue.
Yeah. Anyway, we digress off our wonderful subject of wine. So let's get back to wine.
All righty.
Something else that I've noticed is that, you know, we talk a lot about millennials or a very large cohort, 76 or so million people in the United States. We talk about Gen Z, the next group coming along that's even bigger at 85 million. But if you look at the numbers on who's buying the most wine, who's spending the most wine on the most dollars on wine in the U.S., it's still the baby boomer generation. I recently read some statistics that show that 49% of all dollars spent on wine in the United States are from that boomer generation, compared to millennials, we're at only 15% of the dollars spent.
Wow.
So they're still the largest demographic footprint on the wine business. And of course, the boomers are starting to get a little older too. You know, I'm on the younger end of the boomer, the boom, thank God.
Yes.
Some of the older boomers are starting to slow down a little bit, and they will likely stop drinking as much as they did.
I think that would mean they drink more. I don't know. I could be wrong.
Well, we might buck the trend a little ourselves. You know.
We're a little biased. So just to clarify those numbers, so you have the baby boomers as consuming or purchasing 49%?
Yeah, all the dollars spent on wine in 2017, 2018 at retail, because it's very hard to measure at hard to measure, you know, on premise, but it's pretty easy to measure at retail. So 49% mm-hmm. of all dollars spent were spent by baby boomers.
And millennials were at 15%?
15%. Then I think Gen X, that's a generation between boomers and millennials, was second with 20-odd percent. Yeah. And then the mature generation, the gray-haired generation, was about 5%. And then I guess the balance was for those 22, 23-year-olds that might fall into that Gen Z category, whatever you want to call it.
Gotcha. So then do you still think that, because I know millennials, I mean, are such a target demographic for folks in the wine industry. What does this number kind of tell you that they're not?
Yeah. No, I think what the number tells you is that baby boomers are spending more per unit, i.e. they're buying higher quality, more expensive bottles of wine. Gotcha. Whereas millennials are certainly drinking wine, but they tend to, you know, look at a slightly lower price point as their preferred comfort zone. And I think that's what it really tells you. Wines that are priced, you know, in that $12 to $20 range, that seems to be the sweet spot for millennials. Mm-hmm. Naturally so, because when I was that age, I certainly would have cringed at spending more than $20 on a bottle of wine. Right. Whereas boomers have a little bit more discretionary spending power, so they're not afraid to, you know, spend $30, $40, $50 on a nice bottle of wine. So I think that's what accounts for that percentage variance.
Okay.
Not that millennials aren't drinking wine, they're just drinking less expensive wine.
Okay. I'm glad I clarified, because that was a little surprising to me, but that makes total sense.
Right.
Wonderful.
Yep. So moving on, some other things that I think are really interesting are all the alternatives to the traditional glass bottle. These days, we're seeing very strong growth for alternative packaging, which is kind of not a recent phenomenon, but it's really starting to take off. And besides that retail, I think one phenomenon that not a lot of people saw coming was the popularity of kegged wine on premise. There's a lot. We are selling a lot of wine in keg all around the country. And Florida was a little bit later to adapt to it. But now here in Florida, you're seeing a lot of wine on tap and a lot more variety. Early on, it was mostly just California Chardonnay and, you know, the more reliably sellable wines. But now we're seeing wines from Marlborough and seeing wines from Italy and France on tap. So, and the quality is good.
Yeah, we just got two local restaurants that are doing that now. And it is, like, it's always nicely chilled. The wine is always great. Like, it's such a great option. I'm glad to, so you think we'll be seeing more of that. That's wonderful.
Oh, yeah, a lot more. And I think you hit upon two of the keys. The wines, there's a lot more consistency in terms of temperature, service temperature, mm-hmm. in terms of freshness. I mean, everybody's had a bad experience with a bottle of oxidative wine by the glass in a restaurant. Mm-hmm. Or that red wine that was stored next to the hot water heater that came out about 80 degrees.
Yeah, even the reds that come out of they're like slightly chilled. It's so lovely.
Yeah.
I love ordering those wines.
They're being served at the proper service temperature of 65, 68 degrees. So that's the beauty of it. The downside is the it's just like a beer tap. You have to keep the machinery clean, mm-hmm. service the lines and all that. But I think once people overcome that you'll see more and more, it's going to continue to grow. I talked to a couple people at some big hotel chains that do a lot of wine on keg wine for banquets, mm-hmm. and they love it because they don't have to have an army of waiters or an army of servers walking around with trays of glasses of wine. Customers can even, you know, self pour if they'd like to, or, you know, a server stands there by the keg and, you know, just wine on tap.
Yeah.
it's a beautiful thing. And it doesn't go bad as quickly. So it helps the bottom line. The profit margins are better. So there's a lot of upsides to keg wine. So yeah, it's a hot one and it's not going away.
Great. Great. And how about, were you going to mention wine in like served in cans and that kind of thing as well?
Yeah, I was. If you look for, you know, packaging that's being sold at retail, we're seeing lots of interest in cans. I think early on, the Sophia from Francis Ford Coppola was a good one with a little straw, and people mm-hmm. loved sipping bubbly wine out of a little can. But now they have their Diamond Series in a can, so it's selling popular varieties like Chardonnay and Cabernet Sauvignon and Pinot Grigio, and that is a huge hot brand, triple-digit growth since it was introduced in July 2017, year on year, so comparing 12 versus 12 months, triple digit growth. I think it's 570% growth on just that, on that brand alone. So we're seeing lots of that. So there's a lot of interest in cans. And I think the beer industry sort of really paved the way for the wine industry in cans when all this great craft beer started showing up in cans, and even producers like Lagunitas in California said, oh, we'll never serve our beer in cans ever. We like bottles our package. And then they came out with that beer called the 12th of Never in a can. And they finally said, yeah, we've seen the light. The consumers like cans. So the wine industry, I think, got a good thumbs up from the beer industry on that one. And it seems to be proving true.
Embrace the can.
Yeah, and quality. And I think, you know, the initial stopgap, the impediment to any of this alternative packaging is the presumed notion that the wine is going to be of inferior quality, just like jug wine, you know.
Right.
People have a hard time adopting the screw caps initially, as you'll recall, because they associated it with really low quality wine. And it's been, you know, certainly nothing even close to that. So that's what we're seeing. We're seeing Bag and Box, Black Box, which is a very popular brand. 4 million cases it sold at retail last year, which was up 15%, I think, over the previous year. So, yeah, it's all Tetra Pak, Bag and Box, cans. They're all doing extremely well. So I think that diversity is here to stay.
Wonderful. Yep. Glad to hear that. I mean, all these things do is kind of just ensure the wine tastes better, lasts longer, and make, again, in the end, makes it a better experience for the consumer anyway, right?
Yeah. And one of the big factors there is it's portable. You can take wine in can or bag and box on picnics. You can take it to the beach. You can take it to sporting events. You can take it poolside. Anywhere where glass is not welcome, these alternative packages serve well. So, yeah, that's all interesting things
well
going
said.
On. Yeah.
Fascinating.
And then lastly, there's one more thing, one more trend that I want to talk about, which I think is a great trend as well that I'm very happy to see. And that is the renewed, or I should say continued growth in the interest in green wine and wine made by alternative methods such as biodynamic, organic, sustainably produced wines. We're seeing a lot of new things happening there, which is very heartening because I think the consumer is finally realizing, hey, you know, maybe it's better for me and better for the environment to make wines that, you know, are using these more environmentally friendly practices.
And could you, just for a sec, for those listening, define like what you mean by green wine?
Yeah, green, anything that's, you know, green has sort of become the color for the organic movements because, you know, it's the color of earth and freshness and nature.
Yes.
I think that's what sort of we call that green categories. And for a while, you know, everybody wanted to jump on the green bandwagon, and they're with this wonderful term greenwashing instead of whitewashing, where, hey, I'm green. Look what I'm doing. I'm doing one little thing over here. I'm using those, you know, low wattage light bulbs in the winery. So I'm green too. Truly, truly green. We're talking about people that are practicing these methods in the vineyard and all throughout their estates, and that's where this whole term of sustainable comes into play, where you're not only using organic practices in the vineyard, not using agrochemicals and using natural ingredients for fertilizers for, you know, that are made from natural things like pomace or animal manure. We're looking at the use of alternatives to chemical sprays to combat mildew and insects in the vineyard. But we're also looking at the health of the communities. We're looking at the health of our workers, the long-term sustainability of a business. So all of these things, the conservation of natural resources, keeping water clean, free from agricultural runoff, all of these things sort of incorporate that greater philosophy of sustainability. So I've got some interesting things that I've just recently been looking at. In California, for example, and they, of course, early on have been a leader in sustainable wine growing practices, but there's an organization called CSWA, which is California Sustainable Wine Growing Alliance, and they've just come out with numbers for 2018. They've now announced that 143 wineries and 1,398 vineyards in California are now certified by California Sustainable Wine Growing. So it's not just the practices, it's going out and spending the money and the time and the effort to get the certification. So it's on a label. So a consumer can pick up a bottle and see CCOF or see Certified Sustainable or a number of these other third-party organizations that are certifying vineyards and wineries. to be sustainable, organic, biodynamic. There's a lot of interest in that. I think a lot of consumers are interested, and a lot of that's being driven by the younger generation. So
yes.
Millennials are interested in that sort of thing. Younger people in general. I myself am always looking for, you know, wines that are made by more, you know, environmentally friendly methods. And of course, that includes a number of different things, but the numbers are growing. You're seeing a lot of that. Sonoma County is a great example of that. As of this December, 89% of the vineyard acreage in Sonoma County has been certified as sustainable by a third party approved program.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really incredible. And their goal is 100% sustainability by 2020. And I think they will definitely achieve it.
That's amazing. I couldn't think of a better point to end on, because it's funny, because there really is, even since the little bit over 10 years I've been in the wine industry, there really has kind of been that disconnect between, like, you'll have people who will go to Whole Foods, they'll spend all this money to get, you know, organic meat and vegetables and all of that, but yet they'll turn around and buy, you know, a 1.5 liter bottle of you know, industrially farmed wine. And
right.
I think you're absolutely right that the younger generation is kind of really bringing that to the fore and making it important. And there's really kind of that disconnect. People are amazed when they hear there's other things in the bottle than wine. And I'm going to ask you, how do you feel about ingredient labeling on wine?
I was hoping you'd ask me, because I think it's a very pertinent subject, and yeah. I think it's receiving mainstream attention right now, thanks to Budweiser. I don't know if you saw
really?
Any of the,
No.
I don't know if you watched any of the football playoff ads, but of course Budweiser always advertises heavily, or I should say InBev advertises heavily, and they are now coming out with ingredients labeling on cans of Budweiser, and I think
really?
that's going to be the driver that, you know, gets a lot of beverage alcohol producers to do the same thing. I think you'll see it on spirits bottles. We've been seeing it on some wine labels for a while. I think Randall Graham from Barney Doone was notorious.
Frog's Leap. And there's like three.
Frog's Leap.
Ridge.
Ridge is very, very forthcoming. Hey, my wine contains grapes, yeast, sulfur dioxide. That's it. You know. So I think you'll see a lot more people doing that. And I think it's going to, you know, maybe clean up the industry. Not that there's a lot of bad things in those wines, but I think people would be surprised to find just how manufactured some wines are, with things like tannin powders and, you know, coloring agents like Mega Purple and all these other things that we talk about, that are sort of talked about but not talked about in the wine industry.
Absolutely. And for people listening, like listeners, it's usually a big surprise. They think, oh, it's grape juice. You know, the sun ripens the grapes. They stomp the grapes and then the juice goes in the bottle, when that really can be far from the truth. Would you agree?
Well, certainly not for all wines, but for many wines,
right.
Yes, there's all kinds of little tricks that you can use to make the wine look, taste, and smell better. Again, not dangerous stuff, and we're not trying to hurt you, but it's not what the marketing people would tell you, that it's just the sun-kissed bounty of Mother Nature. You
know?
There's a little bit more to it than that, and that's okay. I mean, I think there are always, you know, some people don't care that their wine has been flavored by oak chips and not, you know, $1,000 French oak barrels, because it really performs the same purpose, but at an affordable cost, because, hey, you know, you're in the wine business to try to make a profit just like any other business. But it is good to see that. I think transparency is a really good thing. And I think the consumer is going to continue to call for more transparency in the wine industry. So.
Amen to that. I'm so glad to hear you say that. So, gosh, you've shared so many wonderful trends and things we can look forward to seeing. Just to recap, so I didn't double check me that I've got all of these great points. If someone's just tuning in. So first we talked about rosé how popular that is. Then we covered bubbles and how kind of bubbly from all over the world is really gaining some great momentum. Sauvignon Blanc as a grape variety is something that's gaining a lot of great momentum too, as are red blends. And then I loved, again, we talked about the cannabis and how that might influence the wine market somewhere in the future. We don't know when, but I'll be sure to have you back on when it does.
All right.
Then we talked about kind of the generations who are really kind of driving the wine market and how they fit in. Alternate packaging, such as kegs, cans, and all kinds of other fun stuff. Boxed wine, and there are great examples of boxed wine too. And then finally, how How would you describe the last point? How wine could be far more sustainably and...
Yeah, I think the sustainable movement is alive and well in the wine industry, and it's being driven both by consumer and by the industry itself. So I think that's something that you'll see more and more people move to. And I think one of the knocks, just to close this, one of the knocks has been that these wines are a little bit more expensive. And that may be true in certain instances, but as it becomes more mainstream and people are able to, you know, farm larger amounts of sustainably grown wine, I think prices will level off. And I think there will be no huge disparity in pricing going forward. And it's funny you mentioned Whole Foods. I actually was speaking to my friend and fellow master sommelier, Devin Broly, from Whole Foods a couple of weeks ago. And he said Whole Foods is going to be adding a 30% bigger space in their retail areas for wines that fall under that organic, biodynamic, sustainable category. So the consumer is definitely responding. So I think you're going to continue to see that grow. And that's such a wonderful thing for the wine industry.
Great. I'm so glad to hear. And if that's not a sign of things to come, I mean, I'm thrilled to hear that. That's wonderful. Wonderful. And then if we could, I just wanted to ask you two questions kind of as we're wrapping up here. Like, what is the one thing that you personally are kind of excited to see more of this year, just on like a personal level and your own tastes?
Boy, it's like asking me to pat one child on the head and neglect another.
Pick a favorite, or it could be a generality, but not a brand, but just a, you know.
Another generality, we didn't really touch upon this, but I'm happy to see wines with a little bit less alcohol becoming more and more wide. I had a Zinfandel from California the other night, which was really good, and I won't name the producer, but you know, we're accustomed to seeing Zinfandel that's well over 15% alcohol by volume. And of course, with our generous leeway that the government offers for alcohol content, you know, those wines can be over 16%. And I was very happy and gratified to drink this wine that was below 14% alcohol, yet had all the flavor, balance, and complexity that you look for in red wine. So that's one of the trends that we didn't talk about that I'm really heartened to see taking place, because I think that's a very important topic. Over consumption of alcohol is another big thing that we don't really like to talk about that much, but it's certainly out there. So I like to see wines that are a little bit more balanced, a little less ponderous, let's put it.
Gotcha. Especially to see that in Zinfandel must have been heartening. Yeah.
Yeah, very heartening. So it just goes to show you don't need to make these hugely alcoholic, over-extracted wines to make a good quality wine. Balance is really still the bottom line.
Wonderful. And if you had to pick something or a trend or something you'd like to see less of, just personally, like less of this year, what would that be?
Less gimmicky wines like Choco Vine and stuff like that.
Amen.
not wine at all. Happily, we've seen that Choco thing sort of fade away. But I'm always cringing at what the next trend will be. So
yeah,
some are good, some are bad. So
what's going to take its place? We don't want to know.
less gimmicky stuff.
Less gimmicky stuff. Right. It doesn't need to be gimmicky. I couldn't agree more. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. I can't thank you enough for being here. I know you're very busy, so.
Well, it was my pleasure, Stephanie. Thanks for having me on. I enjoyed it, and let's do it again sometime.
I look forward to it. And for those of you listening, for any resources mentioned in today's show, you can be sure to find them on my website, theglamorousgourmet.com/episode13. And if you enjoyed this episode, go ahead and review it here on iTunes and go ahead and share it with your friends. I'd greatly appreciate it. Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Cheers.